Hey, hey, everybody. This is Ricky Herbst, and I'm Notre Dame's Cinema Program Director, coming to you from the state-of-the-art Browning Cinema in the lovely DeBartolo Performing Arts Center on the bucolic campus of the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, St. Joe County, Indiana. Thank you for signing up for Truth in Fiction, How to Analyze Documentary Films. I'll say this often, including here. Please do let me know if you have any questions or snags in taking the course. I'm happy to help try and sort those out. And as this is our first online lecture, I note that these talks will be roughly 20 to 30 minutes and will give some depth, at least I hope, to the films we watch. They'll often support and supplement our readings and, in conjunction with the film, hopefully create the base for a neat post-film discussion. As with everything in our course, feel free to have a cafeteria approach to it, but I do encourage you to engage in as many of the four component parts, the online lectures, the readings, the film, and the discussion as possible. During the first 6 weeks, we are watching six films that each approach the overall genre of documentary films from a different vantage point. These films represent subgenres or subtypes of the overall field of documentaries. That is, movies that construct and represent reality in their own various ways. The six subgenres come from Bill Nichols, an American scholar and film theorist who pushed for film to be studied seriously in the academy during the 1970s and eventually did a great deal of work in the field of documentary films. Just as he pushed for film to have its individual set of theoretical and critical analyses, he carved out a space for documentary film, which has been the red-headed stepchild to narrative film throughout history, to be studied and discussed seriously. One of Nichols' lasting impacts in documentary film theory is identifying six subgenres, which he calls modes of documentary. This is important in part because if you can define distinct branches within a topic, it can strengthen the roots of the topic, which is to say it gives the genre of documentary more heft as an academic subject, as something to be studied, if you can start identifying the complexity within the genre. So Nichols looked at film history and analyzed a lot of films and said documentary films tend to work through six different modes or approaches. A note on that. Genres weren't standing stalls when filmmakers set out to make movies. They didn't go to the counter and get a license to make a particular style of film. Rather, think of a river that over time might bifurcate because of an obstruction or erosion in the foundation underneath it, or because humans put a dam up. Suddenly, there's a second course for that water to go or not go. Over time, there are multiple pathways that emerge for someone looking to traverse that river, but that awareness of those various pathways doesn't come right away necessarily. Further, given that Nichols' modes of documentary are reactive and needing to categorize an immense library of documentary films through time, it isn't a very tidy process. Individual films can have qualities of, and sometimes purposely now borrow from, multiple modes. And just as you could break down any subject from various binaries or continua, for example, with sports, you could have sports not in or in or not in the Olympics, individual or team sports, or the amount of energy exerted playing a sport, etc. There are other taxonomies for grouping documentary films, and it's good to check those out, to cross-check how you would categorize these films. But Nichols has a very nice system, and we have 6 weeks before fall break, and he has six modes of documentary, so that's the river cruise we're taking. And this week, we are looking at poetic documentaries. Does that mean we're watching Terrence Davies' A Quiet Passion about Emily Dickinson? Nope, it does not. It means we're going back to actually the earliest form of documentary film to form as a style, which is why our reading includes some of the history at the outset of not only documentary film, but film itself. When film emerged as a medium, there was a great deal of excitement about it. How could it be harnessed as a spiritual tool, as a political tool, as an educational tool, and of course, as an artistic tool? Photographs were exalted for capturing reality and serving as an accurate record of events for a given point in time that were reproducible and immutable. They were literally a snapshot of the world, a memory not necessarily made by the viewer, but a memory of the world at an instant, the thinnest form of time possible. With film came multiple instances stacked against one another. The points became a line through time. The movement between points, a ghost of the last, an ability for the audience to see literally change that will never change. That's pretty trippy. But in modern times, think of the excitement had when cell phones were outfitted with cameras. Then the excitement over the inevitable outfitting of video taking capability in cell phones and what could be done with it. You could document the world. You could record authorities brutalizing citizens. You could record a birthday party. You could accidentally record Schadenfreude worthy of America's Funniest Home Videos and throw online a woman gets hit in the head with a Frisbee and falls on her wedding cake. Why that reception was on a disc golf course, I'll never know. But that excitement came with us after a century of history with film. Imagine being there at the dawn, looking into the vastness of film's potential and thinking, what could be done with this movie camera? Or, if you're the manifesto writing type, what should be done with this movie camera? Ziga Vertov was a Soviet filmmaker and very big idea thinker working after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. And generally after the end of World War I, which colored a lot of his theory. He, along with women and men less known to history, which is worth noting as to contextualize what would become otherwise another great man narrative, they worked together, he and others, they thought and wrote and created films that became the grandparents of multiple strains of documentary modes. But in particular, the poetic documentary. Vertov was not interested in a set of films popular during the time that Tom Gunning calls the cinema of attraction, which was people performing for a camera that caught their humanity at its most cartoonish, dramatic, bold. One might think of the cinema of attraction being the forebearer of American Idol, or MTV's Jackass, or Debbie Does Dallas. Vertov saw in film qualities that made it unique as an art form that could heighten the experience of the world. And those qualities were lost in the straightforward filming of the world's oddities. Vertov believed in film's ability and film's need to capture quote-unquote film truth, which is still known from his Russian as Kino Pravda. With the mechanical lens of the camera as his eye and the film strips as his memory, he saw himself as able to create insight into the world society had never encountered, the world society had never considered. That lens was a very, very big deal for Vertov. He writes about it a ton. And on the human side of things, Vertov groups in with filmmakers who began to write passionately about the importance of editing. They underscore time and time again that the collision between moments captured on film, the editing, is what makes that film entirely unique from other art forms. As people who are writing on this are coming from multiple languages, and individually there are similar thoughts floating through the air. But Vertov comes into the camp believing in the power of montage, which for him meant bringing out the truth of the world by juxtaposing two events that aren't natural twins. From that, new impressions and insights can be given to the audience. His particular method, the way he went about making films, was called the Kino Eye. Vertov seriously thought a lot about eyes and lenses. And Kino Eyes's step breakdown is still a method employed by filmmakers today. And notice the attrition and refinement of experience in each step. So step one, go look at the world and see what you can see as a human engaging it. Step two, think about what you saw. Distill it down to its important parts. See what essences are there. Step three, go back into the world and film the events of the world you saw and found important, you found compelling. Step four, edit the moments together to draw characteristic features from them to create a larger whole. Step five, see what's missing to connect the montage, what road signs or interesting crashes between two moments can be spliced in, and if needed, repeat three and four or one or two to find that glue. And then step six, continue editing to organize a sequence, the final montage or film that brings out the core ideas you want to express about the world, that the film is able to express about the world. Ultimately, bring out the film truth, the Kino Pravda. So there's the six-step recipe for using modern machinery to unveil the truth of the world. In this way of making films without a voiceover normally or telling you what is happening, and instead using the grammar of film, its own language to articulate to the viewer photographic, emotional, and psychological truths. Now that we have discussed the historical underpinning of poetic documentaries, we can start to look at more recent exemplars. And guess what? They're not commonly played at Cineplexes or BAFO at the box office, although Samsara was a top-grossing film for Oscilloscope Laboratories, which was founded by MCA from the Beastie Boys, coincidentally. Now, looking to auteur theory after looking at genre theory, or that the director of a film is how films can be classified as opposed to its stylistic elements in genre, there are some filmmakers and key films who make poetic documentaries. Godfrey Reggio is particularly well known for his Qatsi trilogy, which was scored by Philip Glass. A quick plug, Philip Glass will be lecturing and performing at the DeBartolo Performing Arts Center from March 28th to March 30th, 2019, and we'll be showing Koyaanisqatsi, one of the Qatsi trilogy films, and having him discuss it. In fact, I probably would have shown that film for the class, but we're saving it for the spring. The Qatsi trilogy is very, very similar to Samsara in showing various places of the world, and we can discuss how and if Samsara is a travelogue in that process. It shows the magnitude of the world, the awe created by the places the camera can go, and using film language like slow motion and time-lapse photography and editing and juxtaposing of fragmented scenes, things you can only speak through film to create a heightened experience, to create what Vertov would call Kino Pravda or film truth. In fact, the trailer for Koyaanisqatsi from 1982 ends with the line, quote, "Until now, you haven't really seen the world you live in," unquote. That's chapter and verse Vertov right there. The film exposes truth the film, the human eye, otherwise could not see. Also, we have Chris Marker, a left bank filmmaker, or more political filmmaker from the French New Wave, who made Sans Soleil, which is its own meditation on shared history in the world and collective amnesia through scenes from various continents that unite or don't unite to create themes. Again, you can see a theme between these poetic documentaries. Going back to why we don't see these films very often, Sans Soleil isn't showing up Sunday nights on NBC at 8 p.m. But another reason we don't see a lot of these poetic documentaries is because of gallery culture. Given the relatively small amount of poetic documentaries made, they have a pretty large footprint in art collections and museums and private galleries. Leslie Thornton, who used to teach out at Brown, I think could fall into this documentary mode with some of her films, which includes using found footage to create stories, or not stories or narratives, but rather broad suggestions about the truth of cinema and filming her own images of the world, with which she would sometimes play like a kaleidoscope to reveal the truth of nature. She moved from the experimental film festival circuit to the art gallery circuit, where, interestingly, she was encouraged not to explain her pieces in order for them to have more importance. Explicit explanation was not seen as the goal in the gallery world, where individualized experience often reigns supreme, and that makes poetic documentaries a solid fit. While the poetic documentaries aspire to lead the viewer to truth, the pathway there is much, much looser than in expository films like Central Park 5. Those expository films explicitly state where and what you need to know. Think of them like encyclopedia and poetic documentaries as, well, poetry. And in populations keen on formulating their own viewpoint, being actively involved in the construction of the message, and you find those people often in art galleries, the poetic model goes over better. So these films, poetic documentaries, often lack dialogue, often, I would say, in a way similar to how Leslie Thornton was told not to explain her work. And I think there is only one scene in Samsara where the sound from the ecological world matches the sound of the film world, which we call diegetic sound. The sonic impression runs alongside the images in many poetic documentaries, rather than serving as a second juxtaposition point. And the role of music is very, very important in this genre. The images have enough heft to support a lot of music, which pulls forward the larger themes and truths the filmmaker is looking to present. The images of the world are what really carry their own importance, even if people went to the Kotze trilogy in order to hear a Philip Glass concert. I think poetic documentaries as being somewhat the inverse of concert films in that regard. Whereas in a concert film, you are there for the sound, which is reinforced by images of either the band or, most powerfully, the audience listening to the band. In poetic documentaries, you have sound and image more divorced, with the images often leading the charge. There's a joke here at Notre Dame, particularly from the music-loving folks, that football games are a 15-minute band concert sandwiched between a couple hours of sports. So perspective on how sound and image work together or why they're showing up for a film can shift in terms of spectator. But it's good to see how the music is making you feel, what it represents, what it highlights, how it matches, how it diverges in poetic documentaries, and how we think about and how we recognize and how we place sound and music in documentaries is certainly a larger issue we will tease apart throughout the semester. And with Samsara, we get the third film after Kronos and Baraka, directed by Ron Frick, who did the cinematography on the Kotze trilogy. Samsara, a Sanskrit word conjuring ideas of birth, death, and rebirth, continues the New Age titling choices on these films, which matters, I think. That's how we first understand a film, what its calling card is. Anywho, Samsara bills itself as able to, quote, transport us to sacred grounds, disaster zones, industrial sites, and natural wonders. By dispensing with dialogue and descriptive texts, Samsara subverts our expectation of a traditional documentary instead encouraging our own inner interpretations inspired by images and music that infuses the ancient with the modern, unquote. The film is playing against the dominant type of documentary, which is expository film now, even though the tradition of documentary films started with Samsara's style, making it the traditional documentary. Continuing with the word slicing, notice the word transports. That's a pretty loaded term. We're not checking passports when you walk into the Browning Cinema come Wednesday. You're not being shipped anywhere. So what about us is being transported? How are we experiencing these worlds? And what is the runoff from that experience? How does it change an audience's viewpoint of the world having had some transport? And who gets to have that transport? And what takes us there? Worth noting as well that the film was shot in 70 millimeter, which is essentially high definition film. And it's not digital, which gives the film a depth that brings up its own associations, both in terms of how the audience experiences the film and what it says to the industry, the people who are backing it and pushing it. It also took 5 years to make, with over 25 countries shot, which adds to the lore of how broad and expansive this film must be. That alone is a key part of its marketing material. The production of Samsara also followed Vertov's Sinai method with scouting, shooting, editing, and then using pickup shoots or filler scenes to continue to glue the final film together. And what's pretty amazing, I think, is that you see film reviews that expose different expectations from the film that run along the lines of expository versus poetic documentary. Matt Pays wrote in The Red Eye that Samsara, quote, "Samsara lacks any sense of who, when, where, and why to its imagery. That results in a superficial film that encourages us to judge people and places by their own covers. Maybe you disagree, but I prefer a raw, informed presentation than a film that invites us to be casual observers through a beautiful lens," unquote. Vertov, I think, would disagree. Exposed there is a deep need and want for exposition, something that it's not offering you. And other reviews complain about the lack of knowing what they're seeing. Kenneth Turan wrote in the Los Angeles Times, quote, "Those possessing ordinary human curiosity are likely going to want to know what it is they are looking at. This is a pleasure. However, the film tries its best to deny you it," unquote. One might think this could be an impact of the dominance of expository film in the industry, or perhaps, as Turan writes, that it is a flaw inherent to poetic documentaries. Not that things need to be column A or column B, but I do think this characterization lays to bear the expectations we have when we sit down to see a documentary, and how the very different subgenres often get smacked for being not what the bill of goods said. But the documentary genre is a food court, and we know what we're getting something different when we eat at Sbarro's compared to Panda Express, making it pretty important to be able to spot the signs of what a restaurant is, or completing this flimsy metaphor, what a documentary filmmaker is trying to offer us. With that, I think our stage for Samsara is pretty well set. I hope so, at least. Big thanks to Kevin Krismanich, who manages the technology in the Browning Cinema and serves as engineer on these lectures. And thank you, the listener, very much for signing up for this truth and fiction version of our Learning Beyond the Classics series. I look forward to seeing you Wednesday.